Hello again, friends, and welcome to another adventure as we explore the vaults of radio history and gather again around the old part of radio. I'm your host, Corey Walker, and I welcome you to this special broadcast. If you're Canadian and you're listening to the program on a Sunday, then Happy Canada Day. If you're an American, Happy Independence Day in advance. Both countries' holidays are being celebrated in the special Canada Day Independence Day episode. First, Canada Day. Between October 6 and December 29, 1948, the Canadian Chamber of Commerce produced a miniseries titled The Adventures of Danny Marsden. The title character was a reporter for the Mid-City Sentinel newspaper. His adventures are drawn from articles in this paper that challenged the social ills in Canada at this time in history. We're going to hear two Danny Marsden episodes. First up, the first episode, Out of the Ivory Tower, from October 6, 1948.
I'm Danny Marsden, reporter for the Mid-City Sentinel. Last night, about 40 miles from this town, there was one of the doggonest murders. Now, murder cases are meat and drink to me. Maybe you read what Time magazine said about me when I covered the Lisbane murders. Oh, excuse me. There's Nellie at the switchboard calling. Maybe this is my call to cover last night's case.
Oh, brother.
Hi, Nell. What's cooking?
The chief, Danny. He wants you, but quick.
Sure he wants me, Nell, honey. When there's murder afoot there, you'll find Danny Marsden every time.
Ah, gee, Danny, you're wonderful.
Oh, thanks, kid. Be seeing you. Here I am, Chief. Now, about those murders, I've got very definite ideas where those cops are
out. Now, sit down, Danny. I have a real assignment for you, and it's not murder.
Well, spring it, boss. It must be big if it's bigger than murder.
I've got a letter here that was published on our editorial page last night. I want to read it to you, and then give you the lowdown.
Shoot.
Dear Editor, last Friday I read your editorial calling on working men to increase production. That may be very well for you to say, sitting in your ivory tower at the Mid-City Sentinel, but when I turned to the financial section of your paper, I noticed that the company I work for has increased its profits in the past 10 years over 300%. So you see, to those who have worked hard many years of their lives and have seen many of their salary increases eaten up by a higher cost of living, your nice little editorial about producing and producing and producing just doesn't add up. How about an editorial calling on big companies to cut down on their profits and reduce prices? I dare you, signed John Smith.
Some of our editorials, Chief, with all due respect, aren't so hot. Now, about that murder.
Now, get it into your head. You're not touching the murder. You're working on a different kind of murder. The murder of our economic system by misunderstandings between employer and employee.
But look, boss, I've always had important assignments. Well, the guys will give me their razz if they know I'm out tracking down letters to the editor stuff. Have a heart.
Now, look here, Danny Marsden. When someone says the editors of the Mid-City Sentinel are sitting in an ivory tower, that's important. By heavens, I'm going to show that fellow that nobody around this paper sits in an ivory tower.
Okay, okay, Chief. But it'll ruin my reputation. Gee, when the boys are around town...
Well, tell them it's murder you're covering, if you like. And the corpse is the body politic. Now, get cracking, Marsden, at once. Sitting in my ivory tower, he says.
It's swell being out with you, Danny. We've missed you around the place the last few days.
I'll have another cup of coffee now?
Thanks, I will.
I'm going to let you in on something big.
What's it about, Danny?
Hold on to your hat, Nellie. I'm in a big murder case, and you're the little girl that's going to help me out.
Me? Oh, gee, Danny, that's super.
Well, it's like this, kid. I've spent 3 days already getting the facts in this case, and now I've got to get the lowdown on a fellow called John Smith. He lives out in the suburbs. And I want you to get the information about him before I barge in. Now, this is the way to go about it. You say you represent the A to Z Survey Company, and ask three questions. ...1802 Coulter Boulevard was an innocent-looking little house in a nice suburban district. Nell knocked on the door, and a pretty-looking woman let her in. I stood and watched some 100 yards down the boulevard. It seemed like hours, but finally I heard Nell return.
Well, Danny, I did like you said. I could have talked with Mrs. Smith all night. She answered every question. Her husband was out bowling, and she felt like talking. You know, had the feeling she was worried about him.
Worried? How come?
Well, when I asked her how the cost of living affected them, like you told me to, she said it was tough, but that John felt real mad about it. He has a chip on his shoulder all the time, she said. She's afraid he's getting fed up with his job, and he's so good at it and everything.
Oh, what do you mean, and everything?
Oh, just everything. Why don't you go talk to John Smith yourself? He's at the bowling alley under Brown's store, just on the street there. He's top bowler in the league so far. And if he wins tonight, he'll get the cup. His wife can hardly wait for him to get home.
Now, give me those notes quick. I've got to get to that bowling alley right away. I'll ring you at your apartment later tonight. The community bowling club is doing its stuff, all right. And I had no trouble spotting John Smith after reading Nell's notes. When he made a strike, his final time up, and they handed him the cup, I had him pretty well sized up. I didn't waste any time getting next to him. He invited me home to his place after the bowling.
Well, Danny, I've told you all I can about the bowling league. How about you telling me something?
Yeah, I will. I'm here because you wrote a letter to the Sentinel a few days back.
Oh, that. So what? It's hardly front-page news.
Well, the editor seems to think it is.
There, you see, John, I told you that was a good letter.
It certainly worried my chief.
Worried him? How come?
We're not going to cancel our subscription, if that's it.
Oh, not exactly, Mrs. Smith. The fact is, my editor is the man who wrote the editorial you didn't like.
Oh, well, now...
Just a moment. I should explain that my editor is as completely honest as a man can be. He really believes what he writes, just as you do. And he's always willing to listen to the other side of the question. That's why your letter bothered him. He's willing to admit he may have been wrong.
Well, he was wrong.
Oh, no, not so fast. Personally, I don't take sides in this. I just go after facts, part of my job. I'd like you, if you will, to tell me just why you think he's wrong.
That seems fair enough, John.
Well, I don't think he sees the working man's point of view. Now, for instance, I started in the factory I work for as a floor sweeper when I was pretty young. I'll admit I've done well. I've had raises as I went along, and I worked darn hard for them. But even now, Nora here has a hard time stretching her housekeeping money, and our bank account is growing too slow to suit me.
Well, everybody's cost of living is up.
That's what I'm getting at. And why doesn't your editor tell us why? I can tell you why. Because the big companies are taking too much profit. As I said in my letter, my own company has increased its profits 300% in the last 10 years. Many others are worse. I don't know, but I'll bet it's a fact.
Well, what shall be done about it?
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not a communist or anything like that. But I think we need some changes in our system to make it work for the good of us all. There's something screwy about a system where a fellow keeps getting raises, and the raises don't do any good because prices go right up with them.
Well, we're better off than we were, John. We've a lot of nice things and a fair bank account. We're better off here in Canada than workers are anywhere else in the world.
I know, Nora, but that's not my beef. Just because the workers in other countries aren't doing so well isn't good enough. We want to do well here, much better than we are. And I'm sure it could be done. But just asking the working man to produce more isn't the answer. Prices have to be kept down, and profits. The government should do something about it.
John, I'm not sure you're going to like the article I'm going to do for the paper. But I'd like to tell you what I plan to write. Part of it you'll like, and part of it you may not like. But you sound like a reasonable guy, and I think if I can prove that what I've written is true, you'll go for it.
Yes, I'll go for anything that's true, Marsden. I hope I'm not a crackpot anyhow.
That's true, Mr. Marsden. We get puzzled and worried and sometimes pretty mad. But we're reasonable people, we think.
Well, I spent 3 days checking up on the company you work for. I don't know why. But they gave me the run of the place and showed me everything. Now, I'll give you the reasons why I'm going to tick them off in my article, and the reasons why I'll tick you off a little, too. No names mentioned, naturally, okay?
Shoot, Danny, and you don't have to pull any punches.
Well, in the first place, your company is at fault because they've let you go on thinking over the many years you've worked there that they've been piling up terrific profits. Now, the facts are that 10 years ago, they'd made only 2.3% profit on sales, and today they make even less, only 2.2%. That 300% increased profit you read about in the paper got you mixed up. And here's what it amounts to. 10 years ago, their net profit was only $40,000-odd. And now it's increased to something like $200,000. During that same period, production increased, sales more than tripled, and 40 new jobs were created. Well, the whole thing is like the story of the man who increased his sales 100%. He sold one pair of shoes one day, two pairs of shoes the next. Percentages can fool you, unless you know the facts.
Hi, Nellie. The chief in?
He's only been shouting for you for the last hour. And by the way, what happened to you last night? You were going to phone me.
Oh, when I left the Smiths, it was after midnight. Say, how's about dinner tonight? Oh, you know, to make up for it. We'll celebrate.
Celebrate what?
I got a story last night that'll make the boss's eyes pop. I sent in to him this morning before I went out for breakfast.
He's on the line now, and he doesn't sound like he's exactly pop-eyed about your story. He wants to know where in the blankety-blank you are.
Tell him I'll be right in. And you call me, Chief?
Yeah, sit down. Sit down, Marsden. I liked your article, Marsden. It's dynamite. I've been trying to get you for half an hour. I had John Smith in my office.
John? Well, last night he was convinced that
he came in to tell me that you, Marsden, should be on our editorial staff. Says you're wasting your time covering murders. He intimated that maybe I could take your place while you took mine. He brought up some good points, though, Marsden. Claims that one of our duties should be to make our financial page more understandable to our readers. Says that most folks can't understand a financial statement, for instance. It's up to us to present them in a simpler manner. He says we should do more to explain profits. He even quoted you, Danny. He also quoted the famous labor leader, Samuel Gompers. You remember, something to the effect that any firm that fails to make a good profit is letting its employees down. He pointed out we've done too much editorializing and not enough explaining of facts. For instance, he says that you were the first person to point out to him that the average profit made by Canadian manufacturers is only 6.2 cents on the sales dollar. His company's only making 2.2 cents on the dollar. He figures that's one reason why raises haven't come as fast as he feels they should.
Oh, Smith's a good guy. Lots of sense. Now, what did you tell him?
I told him it was time he got out of his ivory tower. At the same time, I admitted we might improve. We got along pretty well, as a matter of fact.
You know, it's a funny thing, Chief. I found this job interesting, too.
Marsden, this story you've turned in is good. It should persuade management and labor that they can get together and make more money for everyone concerned. But it only scratches the surface. I want a whole series of such factual articles. And you, Danny, are elected.
Oh, look, Chief, I'm not a professor of economics.
That's exactly why you're writing this series. You're a trained newspaper man without prejudices. And your tops are digging out facts.
Boss, you're flattering me. I'm a pushover for it.
Nonsense. I'm just telling you that you're the man for the job.
Well, I'll do my best. Nellie, that dinner date tonight.
You want to cancel it.
Baby, what's the dinner? You wear your best gown, kid, because we're not only dining, we're going to see the town. I've got the boss eating out of my hands.
Gee, Danny, isn't murder a wonderful thing?
You just heard the episode Out of the Ivory Tower from the Canadian series The Adventures of Danny Marsden. This was the first episode of the miniseries and dates to Wednesday, October 6, 1948. Danny Marsden is the only old Canadian series that's available on the web. If you have access to any other Canadian radio programs now in the public domain, please let me know. You would please thousands of old-time radio fans. We have one more episode from The Adventures of Danny Marsden coming up. This episode is titled Citizenship and was first heard on various Canadian stations on Thursday, December 16th, 1948. Enjoy.
Well, idea of yours, to drive out of town for a picnic in your new car.
Huh. Thanks for calling it a new car.
Well, it's new to you anyway, even if it is a 1938 model.
Well, anyway, I figured we've earned an afternoon off. My next article doesn't have to be written till Friday. A fellow has to relax once in a while, you know. Hey, you've been a faithful and hardworking assistant, too, kid. You've earned a break.
Thanks. By the way, Danny, what is your next assignment?
Citizenship. You know, Nellie, we're looking at something right now that ties in with the idea of citizenship.
We are? Personally, I was looking at the hats in that store window we just passed.
No. I mean right here on this road. Look at the cars. Dozens of them. And every one with plenty of horsepower under the hood. Now, what would happen if there were no rules? If every driver could do just exactly as he liked?
It'd be sort of messy, wouldn't it?
You said it. What keeps it orderly? What keeps all the cars from getting mixed up and smashing into one another? Cooperation, that's what. Everybody agrees to stay on the right side of the road. You can go fast or you can go slow, just as you like, providing you don't endanger the other fellow. Now, there's nothing to stop you from getting ahead of the car in front of you either, providing you can do it safely without hurting anybody. You know, that's the basic principle of citizenship in a democratic country, Nellie. Getting ahead whenever you can, in whatever way you want to. but always respecting the other fellow's rights.
Danny, don't look now, but I think somebody bumped into you.
Let's get out and look. Look at that fender. Why, that big ape, he can't do a thing like that. What does he think, he's driving a tank? I'll pin his ears back. What good, that big stiffer.
Danny, he's coming now.
Well, we seem to have run into a bit of trouble here, eh?
Trouble is right. Look at my fender.
Oh, I wouldn't worry too much about your fender.
Not worry about it, but look at it.
I know, but save your worrying for your left hind wheel here. It seems to be a little bent.
Holy shamoleon. I didn't notice that. It's practically flat on the road.
My fault entirely. I was daydreaming. Bad habit I have when I'm driving. Don't worry. I'll see that the damage to your car is taken care of and paid for.
What? Oh, gosh, thanks.
In the meantime, of course, you people are stuck without transportation. I'd suggest, first, that we call a garage from the nearest payphone and have them tow your car away to be fixed. And second, that you two then proceed by taxi at my expense. Incidentally, my name is John Nesbitt.
John Nesbitt? The Member of Parliament?
That's right.
Well, I'm Danny Marsden, Mr. Nesbitt, reporter for the Mid-City Sentinel.
I'm glad to meet you, Mr. Marsden. I've read all your articles. Very good stuff indeed.
Oh, thank you. What are you speaking about this afternoon?
Canadian citizenship.
Well, I'll be darned. Is it a public meeting?
Why, yes. Why?
Oh, well, Mr. Nesbitt, if you'll just wait here a moment while I dash into that drugstore and call a tow truck, I'll be right back. You won't need to call a taxi. There's lots of room in your car for Nellie and me. And your audience this afternoon is going to be increased by two.
And so we come to the question, what exactly is citizenship? Citizenship in a country means to belong to that country in the fullest sense of the word. It means, in its ideal sense, to identify your aims and aspirations as much as possible with those of your fellow citizens, to recognize that you and they are marching forward together to a common destiny in which you will all share. But you cannot belong passively. You must do your part in shaping that common destiny. How does a Canadian citizen play his part? I can think of three important departments of life which call for citizenship from the individual man and woman. The first that springs to my mind, though perhaps it is not the first in importance, is politically. To be a good citizen politically is to take a lively interest in politicians and political parties and in the political questions of the day, not only in the field of national affairs, but in foreign affairs as well. It requires that you find out everything you possibly can about the men who represent you in Ottawa, and also that you keep those men fully acquainted with your wishes and your opinions. And, of course, it requires that you cast your vote on voting day for the man you think best qualified to represent your interests in Parliament. The tendency in the democratic countries has been more and more to place in government hands powers that affect the life of the individual citizen. Thus, we look to the government to provide for us in our old age. We look to the government to provide financial help in rearing our children. We look to the government to protect us against unemployment. In short, we are making the government more and more responsible for our welfare, and therefore shouldering less and less of that responsibility ourselves. Now, if this is what we want, and it seems to be what the majority want, then that's what we will get. But we have to face the fact that we lose a certain amount of freedom when we do this. If we carry the process too far, we shall lose too much freedom. The state will be running our lives for us. We shall then be in exactly the same boat as the Germans were under Hitler and as the Russians are today.
Danny, he's really good.
The second department of life which calls for citizenship is the economic field. Every one of us is a part of Canadian business. As an employer or an employee or a small business proprietor or a professional man or a consumer. Now, the Canadian economy can be improved. Everything ever created by the hands of man can be improved. but a conscientious citizen of Canada will do nothing to undermine our economic setup. While he works to advance himself, and Canada's economy gives him every opportunity to do that, he will never seek his own advantage at the expense of someone else. Furthermore, and this is very important, he will seek out the true facts about the free enterprise economy of Canada so that he can never be misled by those who would try to persuade him that it is fundamentally wrong and should be replaced by something else. As citizens, we all have a constructive part to play in Canada's economy. We must not shirk that responsibility. Citizenship of the highest order is also called for in the third department of life, which, for want of a better word, I have called the social department. How do we show citizenship in this sphere? For one thing, we realize that there are no such things as degrees of citizenship. There are no second-class citizens in Canada. Whether a man is a banker or a bricklayer, whether his skin is white or black or brown or yellow, whether he is a Protestant or a Catholic or a Mohammedan, these things do not make him superior or inferior. He is as much entitled as you are to be treated as a human being, to be accorded the protection of Canadian law, and to enjoy all the rights of Canadian citizenship. As a Canadian citizen, you have a stake in Canadian democracy. You cannot expect to enjoy the good things of citizenship without working for them. Nor can you expect to keep the freedom you now have and the high standard of living that is now yours without working incessantly at this business of being a good citizen. Not so very long ago, Canadian citizenship, which had long been an established thing in fact, became an established thing in law when the Citizenship Act was passed. But you must always remember one thing. No matter how many acts it passes, the government cannot make you into a Canadian citizen. Only you can do that. This was a wonderful idea of yours, Danny, inviting me along to your picnic. I'm grateful.
Oh, we're delighted you could come, Mr. Nesbitt. I got a lot of good ideas from your speech this afternoon, but I'd like to get more. That is, if you don't mind talking about it.
I should say I don't. What can I tell you?
Well, I must admit that I don't know for sure. This subject of citizenship is a complicated one, and it's kind of hard to know where to start.
I know it is. I think I'd better pull into this service station and get some gas. We'll take up that citizenship theme again after, Danny.
How many?
You better fill her up, please, and check the oil, too, will you?
Okay. I guess you want the better grade of gas, eh?
Yes, please.
Costs you 40 cents a gallon.
I know.
Too darn much for gasoline. Well, you probably think I'm crazy talking like that when I'm selling the stuff. But what the heck? Ridiculous prices are ridiculous prices, is what I say.
You do, eh?
I sure do, bud. The filling station business ain't what it used to be. All on account of ridiculous prices for gasoline. You know whose fault it is that gasoline prices are so high?
I'll bet.
The government's, that's whose. Surprised you, eh? Thought I'd say the oil companies, didn't you? Well, it's the government. Taxes, taxes, taxes. They pile taxes onto gasoline till the price gets where it's ridiculous.
Well, why don't you do something about it?
You kidding? What can anybody do about the government? The politicians run it to suit themselves.
But ordinary people elect the politicians to office.
That's it exactly, mister. Come election day, you got a choice between two, maybe three politicians, and they're all alike. What chance have you got?
Join a political party. Get together with some other fellows who feel the same way as you do, and put up your own candidate for office. Anybody in Canada can do that. Didn't you know that?
Well, I guess I didn't know that, but holy cow, I ain't got time to go sashaying around putting up candidates for the government. Running this here garage is a full-time job, mister. You believe me. Well, I guess I better get busy and fill up the gas tank.
Well, our garrulous friend at the service station gave us a pretty sharp object lesson on what good citizenship isn't.
I'll say he did.
The tragedy is that his attitude is a pretty representative one.
Oh, his big beef was about taxes. I kind of sympathize with him there. Do you really think that if enough plain citizens in Canada got mad enough about high taxes and squawked loud enough to their MPs, taxes would be reduced?
Well, first, the MPs, if they were honest, would reply to their constituents that taxes could be reduced all right. But that if they were, there wouldn't be enough money to provide a lot of the social services the government provides today. The so-called free services that are actually paid for out of every taxpayer's pocket. I just thought of something. If you'll open the glove compartment, Danny, you'll find a number of pamphlets there. I think you'll find them useful in writing this article of yours.
Oh, okay. These look pretty good. Say, I like this paragraph. Hey, Nellie, listen to this. Recently, some 5,000 high school students in five different communities of Ontario were asked what they understood by the word democracy. A small percentage of the answers revealed that the student had no conception. About 90% of those writing apparently thought of democracy in terms of rights and privileges only, and less than 10% made any mention of any duties or responsibilities which the average citizen must shoulder if our democratic way of life is to prevail. Now, here's another good point. In Canada, letters to the newspapers come chiefly from persons who hold extreme views on economic and religious questions. And this makes many people unwilling to write their share of public letters. In England, on the contrary, all the best papers contain a constant stream of correspondence from the most responsible people in the country.
Yes, it's a pity more people, and especially more intelligent people, don't write to the papers.
Oh, here's a sentence from the Canadian Chamber of Commerce's booklet on national affairs committees. Better government is not hard to get. You just help yourself. The citizens themselves must want it enough to make the necessary effort to get it.
That's the problem in a nutshell, Danny.
You know, Mr. Nesbitt, I've learned a great deal from you today. I learned a lot from listening to your speech, and I learned a lot from our conversation, too. But probably the most valuable lesson I've had has come from seeing a good citizen in action.
I hope you enjoyed that radio play. You were listening to the episode Citizenship from the Adventures of Danny Marsden, the only Canadian old-time radio series I've been able to find available anywhere. The episode was first broadcast on Thursday, December 16th, 1948, near the end of the mini-series' almost three-month run. I think the messages in both Danny Marsden episodes apply just as much today as they did back then and on both sides of the border. Next, something to celebrate Independence Day for my American listeners. I came across an interesting series from 1969-1970 on the life of former U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. The 13-part documentary was produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University and is described as a, quote, chronicle in sound of the Dwight Eisenhower years. Today I'm going to play part 5, which is titled D-Day, The Prelude. Let's have a listen.
April of 1942. Hitler's war machine was driving toward the Caucasus on the west while Rommel's Afrika Korps neared El Alamein. And the fear was a Nazi link-up between those two. There continued ominous intelligence reports of German heavy water production in Norway. The Allies were in the shadow of what General Marshall called a very black hour. In Washington, the Assistant Chief of Staff in charge of war plans, Major General Dwight Eisenhower, drafted a plan to strike a major blow against the Germans in Europe. It called for a cross-channel invasion of France on the Normandy beaches. It was the beginning of what was to be the biggest military operation in history. It would take 2 years of planning, building, and preparation. And D-Day would mark the beginning of the end of Nazi Germany.
He had to decide on whether to go with the weather the way it was or to postpone it 2 weeks.
General of the Army Omar Bradley recalls the agony of decision on those fateful days in June of 1944 as the Supreme Allied Commander weighed invasion against delay.
You could only get a suitable tide and daylight together once every 2 weeks. And if we didn't go on the June the 5th, 6th, or 7th, we couldn't go until 2 weeks later.
I possibly sat silently just reviewing these things, maybe, well, I'd say 35 or 45 seconds. Well, yet I just got up and said, okay, we'll go, and this room was emptied in 2 seconds.
The Eisenhower Years, a chronicle in sound of the life of Dwight Eisenhower, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University.
Superlatives regarding D-Day and its planning are myriad. The mightiest armada ever. The biggest military operation in history. The beginning of the end for Hitler. D-Day was all of those. It involved staggering amounts of money, energy, and endurance. Actually, the concept of an Allied return to the continent was born in the minds of the British at Dunkirk. Churchill assigned a small group of planners the task of devising such a plan in 1940. But the specific cross-channel plan came from Eisenhower in 1942. It was that year that then Brigadier General Eisenhower was named Assistant Chief of Staff in charge of war plans in Washington. In a memo to his boss, General George Marshall, Eisenhower outlined his views of global strategy, and a key point was the retention of Russia in the war. He called for materiel aid to Russia and also an Allied thrust to Europe, big enough to draw off a sizable portion of the German army on the Russian front. His plan was for a cross-channel invasion. Roosevelt and the U.S. Chiefs of Staff agreed to it for the spring of 1943. Churchill asked for and got an invasion of North Africa first, and the cross-channel invasion was put off until 1944. Full-scale planning of the invasion was started in 43, commanded by a British Lieutenant General Frederick Morgan. Joining the staff that year was U.S. General Omar Bradley.
The British staff had been working on the landing for several months when I went to England in October, the 1st of October of 43. And we didn't get down to detail planning until I came up in January. He came up in North Africa, having been designated to take supreme command, and made several basic decisions, and then on, from January on till June, we were doing planning, detailed planning.
In the last 2 months of 1943, the time came for President Roosevelt to name a supreme Allied commander. The choice in everyone's mind was between Generals Marshall and Eisenhower. It was Roosevelt's decision. Author, biographer Ken Davis says Roosevelt originally opted for Marshall.
I think Marshall himself made the decision in a sort of funny way. Marshall wanted it, oh God, he wanted to be Supreme Commander. He wanted it so bad. But he also realized that he had been tangling with the British all these years. They tangled at the Arcadia Conference, they tangled over and over again. They tangled about Torch. He was opposed to Torch. He and the British had been fighting, as he had to do. I mean, he was the American. And so that he could not have done as well as Ike did, because he was already tagged with certain points of view, whereas Ike had none that he was tagged with. So that though Marshall, if Marshall had said he wanted it, he would have had it. Roosevelt would have appointed him. And certainly Churchill would have gone along. And a lot of other people thought that they couldn't live without Marshall in Washington. Roosevelt himself said, you know, to Marshall, he said, I don't think I can sleep well at night with you out of the country. So I really think it was Marshall who decided that he should not be and that Ike should be. Ultimately, it was him.
The announcement of General Eisenhower's appointment as Supreme Allied Commander came on Christmas Eve, 1943. Ike arrived in London the next month, and the man who became his public relations officer, Lieutenant Colonel Thor Smith, remembers that day.
He arrived in the middle of one of the very worst historical pea soup fogs that London has ever had. And of course, we were in a frenzy to get the releases out and all that sort of thing, and we actually had to walk from one place to another in front of a Jeep with a flashlight. It was as bad as all that. One of the first things we had to do was get a picture of the high command, General Ike and Tedder and all the rest of the big brass, the famous war room picture that you've seen around was trying to get all of that brass together in one room, and with all the cameramen that wanted to get a picture of it. Well, it was really quite a first assignment for me with General Ike.
Many people feel that Eisenhower's greatest accomplishment was the forging of Schaeff, his ability to weld and then wield an Allied sword. Biographer Kenneth Davis.
He knew what Schaeff ought to be. He insisted that there be an actual fusion and no nationalism whatever in the headquarters. And he insisted on optimism and courage, and he did a beautiful job there. It was Ike who made Schaeff.
But Ike had his problems in managing the British and American brass. And one of his biggest problems was Field Marshal Montgomery. They frequently clashed on tactical decisions, and Ike often found Montgomery hard to handle. General Omar Bradley.
He was hard to handle, yes. And he always was very egotistical. And he thought he should have been made the Supreme Ground Commander. And Ike insisted that he was acting as such. He was a little bit hard to handle sometimes by Ike. But after all, Ike got us to work together. And we won. Always a big thing, he won.
Thor Smith, who now had become Ike's public relations officer, recalls the problems with General Montgomery and says they were heightened by the British press.
In a way, some of the British press had a sort of a chip on the shoulder, you know. General Ike's main concern all through this was not to disturb the Allied unity. But the press, admittedly, they were constantly speculating about is Mahdi number two in command? Or when's General Bradley going to take charge of American troops in the field? And any shift at all was considered a slight on the other, and it ended up being this is one of the stickiest problems that General Eisenhower had to cope with. And of course, the press didn't help any, and in this respect, why he was a little bit sensitive toward any think pieces about the command structure.
About the first thing Eisenhower did after assuming command was to enlarge the D-Day plan. Both he and Montgomery felt that it was not broad enough. The Cossack plan called for a three-division amphibious assault on the Normandy coast, with the assumption that there would also be simultaneous landings on the south of France with two divisions. But all the key leaders, Eisenhower, Montgomery, Marshall, and Churchill, agreed the three-division landing in Normandy was too small. It was expanded to include all five divisions, and the south of France operation was delayed. Now the planning, detailed planning, became intense. General Bradley.
You were working 18 or 20 hours a day, and you had to have certain basic decisions on which to break it down. And the planning of an invasion, amphibious operation, is a very detailed job. You have to plan the load of every little boat that goes in, every landing craft. And I remember one figure which is rather impressive to me, and that is that during the first, I think it's 4 hours, we landed some 7,000 different items on the beach, and they had to be in the right proportion. That includes different surgical instruments and weapons and ammunition and everything else. 7,000 different items. It had to be planned to go in the right landing craft. It takes a lot of detail.
We had to have a particular combination of tides, light, and moon. And this was showed that you had about a few days in June where you could have the perfect conditions, or nearly perfect conditions, and a few days in May. We'd like to have gone on the 5th of May. But to get the breadth of attack we thought necessary, we had to wait until June. Now, the ideal days were from June 4th. 5th was the ideal day, but 4th was satisfactory, 5th, 6th, and 7th, and even possibly 8th. But that would have been stretching a little bit. Now, I picked June 5th as the best. And we came down here, hoping and praying that the weather would be sufficiently good we could go on the June 5th.
Had to approve the beaches on which we landed, which was quite a decision. Where do we go, Pas-de-Calais or Normandy, or go farther south? Where do you go? He had to approve that. He had to decide on the troops that would land on each of the five beaches and what support they could get. And he had a lot of decisions to be made in connection with D-Day. And it turned out they were all good.
By now, the British Isles were jammed with men and equipment. So much that a common joke was the only thing keeping her afloat were the barrage balloons. Logistics became the key element of the war against Hitler, and the massive plan took final shape. It was massive in more ways than one. For instance, a complete set of Navy orders, including maps, weighed 300 pounds. And while this went on, so did a concerted intelligence effort to fool the Germans across the Channel. General Bradley.
The German agents in England, and the British knew them pretty well, they were tipped off that we were going to invade in Pas-de-Calais, and we built up a paper army in East England. We even took the radio operators from Africa and with certain divisions, and because they get to know the radio operator's touch the way you know somebody's voice. So we actually sent these operators up, and they sent messages back and forth. The Germans, of course, picked them up, and they believed we were going to invade at Pas-de-Calais. We even went to the trouble of building platforms that looked like boats. For example, just take boards and lay them on the water in the shape of a hull of a ship. From there, it looks like a ship. And we even went to the trouble of laying those boards up there to make them look like ships in those harbors and so forth. And they left that 15th Army up around Pas-de-Calais even after we landed in Normandy, because they were sure that was just a feint and we were going to make the main landing at Pas-de-Calais. That was Hitler's idea mostly. I think the German general saw through it, and but Hitler wouldn't give in. He said those divisions had to remain up there for the main invasion. And they didn't pull them out until we broke out of the beachhead, 25th of July.
Thor Smith.
It was one of the best cover and deception plans, I'm told, has ever been handled in the history of warfare. I saw a list one time of all the different elements of the cover and deception plan that went on, and it was about 25 different things, all knitted together like this. By that, I mean, you know, fake divisions here and a fake story in a newspaper there, and you know, the thing was all buttoned up.
An invasion of Europe involving men by the millions, more than 10,000 planes, in excess of 1,000 ships. And yet it had to remain secret. There were hair-raising slip-ups, but the Germans never really found out. General Bradley.
I still don't understand, because too many people knew about it. We went on the basis that only those who needed to know were told about it. But I know a lot of people that didn't need to know were told about it. And it's just still a miracle to me why the Germans didn't pick it up.
Eisenhower's personal aide, Harry Butcher.
There were numerous incidents that were very worrisome. Officer or two talking at a cocktail party, giving the name of the date of D-Day. It really hadn't been settled, but first week of June was close enough, you know. There was a case of one. Now, turning up in Chicago, all the plans at the home of a German named family, a family of German descent with a German name, in a great batch of mimeographs, the plans for D-Day. And this caused a lot of consternation. It was discovered by some counterintelligence officers or listed men in Chicago. And of course the word came back to our headquarters and it was looked into immediately, and what had happened was that a GI in the mailroom, taken about home by his family, inadvertently addresses this package to his family. It's supposed to go to the War Department by courier. But in some way, it gets in the mail addressed to his family.
So it was a scare for a while. But then on the night of D-Day, the day before D-Day, one of the American Press Associations in its London office inadvertently put on a D-Day announcement in practice. But fortunately, it was caught before it ever got printed.
As the time for the invasion drew nearer, the planning phase was completed. Then it became a question of time as the buildup of men and machines continued. It was also a question of what to do with General Ike for his aide, Harry Butcher.
From where I sat in this tent camp, it was a problem of trying to keep some diversion for General Ike. Maybe you'd play some bridge, and maybe you'd dream up a trip to see the paratroopers the night of D-Day. Maybe you'd go down to the hards, the places where the landing craft loaded with troops and the like. Go and keep busy, keep something going on.
Thor Smith.
A long time before the advance command post was set up, he started in going out visiting the troops all over England. He would take Churchill along one time and Montgomery along another time and frequently go on his own. And so we were really traveling tourists there for several months before D-Day. He felt that one of the best things in the world was the morale building of the troops, was to just go see them. And so we went every place. Usually, on these visits, we would be in a convoy of sorts, and inasmuch as I was conducting the press, we'd be about two or three cars back. And just about the time we would come alongside of whoever it was, that would be the delayed reaction. They'd realize who it was that was coming to see them. If it was General Ike or Churchill or somebody like that. And it was just for us, being three cars back, two or three cars back in the convoy, it was just a constant succession of these wide-eyed, amazed faces of realizing who it was that they'd just seen.
Now, the day actually approached. The tenseness in the Eisenhower headquarters increased.
He was a bit irritable for a week or 10 days beforehand. He had asked the cook to find some, bake some beans. And he wanted the beans baked in a certain way. And none of us quite knew just how he wanted them baked. So we had four or five kinds of beans over a period of days. And he was never quite satisfied with any of the beans, and he vowed that he could make better beans than the cook was making.
One of Ike's key decisions came just before D-Day, regarding the paratroop drops to precede the invasion. General Bradley said they were imperative, but Air Marshal Lee Mallory, who was in charge of the air operations, felt the losses would be too high. General Bradley.
I wanted Airborne Division to drop back of Utah Beach because right back of the beach there was a big swamp which the Germans had flooded, and just two or three narrow causeways going across. Well, a machine gun on each one of those, it just caused you a lot of trouble because you can't flank them out. You can't get out and wade through the swamp. It's too deep. So I wanted the back of those swamps and the other end of those causeways secured by airborne. So the plan was to put the 82nd and 101st Airborne back of Utah Beach. And General Air Marshal Lee Mallory, the British man in charge of the air, objected. He said the losses to the airborne troops would be too great. And he didn't want to approve it, but Ike finally approved it, and we went ahead, and it's a good thing because they did drop back of that swamp and secure the outlets, and we went very fast off of Utah Beach.
Harry Butcher also recalls that Eisenhower decision.
The morning of D-Day, I happened to take the call in the tent camp at our command post of Air Marshal Lee Mallory, who was calling to convey to General Ike his congratulations on the decision to have the airborne operation go forward, that it had worked, and that he was relieved, and that the losses were substantially less than he had predicted. He was a very good sport about it, typically British, apologized for being putting a burden and extra responsibility on the Supreme Commander.
Ike was faced with another problem, another decision. This one involving Winston Churchill himself.
Churchill wanted to go on the on a destroyer on D-Day to be to see the action, to be a part of the invasion. And Ike had to tell Churchill that you were worth to me alive and safe and sound, away from the battle, in your regular job as prime minister. You're worth to me two divisions at least. If you go on this, if I let you go on the invasion fleet, it'll take X number of ships to look after you, and you'll be a nuisance. And Churchill had to, wasn't satisfied with this decision. He wanted to go. And he said, I shall have to go to His Majesty and offer to lay down the mantle of my high office unless you let me go on this venture. And Ike said, no, I've told you, I don't want you to go. And he didn't go.
But the big decision came for Dwight Eisenhower as the window of go days arrived that first week of June, and the weather turned sour. Eisenhower recalled those days in a CBS interview filmed at Southwick House, Ike's advanced headquarters at Portsmouth.
Early on the morning of June 4th, I came from my camp about a mile from here, came in this room. And Captain Stagg, who was the chief meteorologist for the Allied forces with me, he was supported by two or three Americans, a couple other Britishers. But he made the presentations. That morning, the stars were out, it looked beautiful, and he gave us the worst report you ever saw. And he talked about gales hitting the Normandy beaches, and winds up to, you know, the rate of 45 miles an hour, that kind of thing. Landing would be impossible. So I just said, all right, we have to postpone. So we postponed for 24 hours.
The morning of the 5th, that scene was repeated in the midst of a storm that shook Southwick House and proved the prediction of meteorologist Captain Stagg.
He said, well, I'll give you some good news. And then he told us about this high that got in here and gave us some hope. And he, as I remember, he predicted this good weather would last between 24 and 36 hours. Now, that wasn't too good because you could get so many troops ashore and then have to stop landing and be pretty bad. But we were trying for these, these artificial ports, and we hoped that with this break, we could do it. It was still a chancy thing. But when he gave it and said that the waves now on the beaches were not going to be more than 3 feet or something of that kind, and the wind was going down, there'd be some opportunity for bombing, and the gunfire from the naval ships could be spotted pretty well, I thought it was just the best of a bad bargain. So I possibly sat silently just reviewing these things, maybe, well, I'd say 35 or 45 seconds. Now, it's been reported by some of the people present. For example, my own chief staff says that's 5 minutes. Well, I know that wasn't, but 5 minutes under such conditions sounds like a year. Actually, I'd think after 30, 45 seconds, something like that, I just got up and said, okay, we'll go, and this room was emptied in 2 seconds.
I think that's one of the most far-reaching decisions made during the whole war, because 2 weeks later, there was a storm. We couldn't have gone in. It was much worse than the one we went in. And so we couldn't have gone 2 weeks later. And we had to get a port for supplies before the 15th of September, because in the channel, the storms get so bad after the 15th of September that you can't land supplies over the beach. So if we hadn't gone when we did, I don't know when we could have gone.
The decision made, and now the waiting. General Eisenhower recalled those long hours.
Well, of course, that's the most terrible time for the senior commander. He's done all that he can do, all the planning. And matter of fact, there's very little more that any commander below, above division command can do anything after once you get started. So the first thing I did, I went over and fortified myself with a lot of coffee and breakfast. Then I began to go up and down the wharves. Some of the ships were still starting out, and I saw people that had sent them off and so on. And I came up here during the middle of the day to see if any news coming out, and I kept pretty close to my communication center. And then finally, along about 6 in the evening, I went over to a field from which the airborne, the American airborne, started out. Now, I couldn't go to all these fields because there were many of them. But I did go into the 101st Division, and it was a very fine experience. They were getting ready and all camouflaged and their faces blackened and all this. And there they saw me, and of course they'd recognize me. They said, now quit worrying, gentlemen. We'll take care of this thing for you. And that kind of things was a good feeling. But as they started off, I watched them out of sight. Then it took me a couple hours to get back to my headquarters.
Thor Smith.
We didn't get back until the early hours of the morning, and then we knew that H hour was just a few hours away, so we stayed up, and it was very tense because it was the show was on, but there was no feedback at that point, and so you just nothing to do except sit and wait for, and actually a little frustrating too. I mean, even for General Ike, it wasn't anything for him to do except sit and wait.
And as he waited, 1,000 ships were churning through the English Channel, and within a few hours, the 6th of June, 1944. Would take its place in the memory of mankind.
The Eisenhower Years, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University on a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The producer-narrator is Ralph Titus, research by Anne Frank. Music for the Eisenhower Years was composed by Gail Kubik, performed by the Kansas State University Chamber Symphony, conducted by Luther Levengood. Our thanks to CBS News for providing General Eisenhower's interview at Southwick House. Next week, D-Day, the conclusion. This is Paul DeWeese.
To say that I'm really impressed with that documentary, which provided an informative insight into the life of Dwight Eisenhower during the lead-up to the D-Day invasion, which any historian will agree was a key turning point in the Second World War for the Allied forces. I picked an episode from the series as I felt it was something American enough to include on an Independence Day episode, but would still be interesting to my Canadian listeners as well, despite today being Canada Day here on my side of the border. The episode was titled D-Day Prelude and was part 5 of a 13-part documentary titled The Eisenhower Years. It was produced at Kansas State University between 1969 and 1970. The sound in the hourglass has almost run out, so I'm going to pass along my contact information because I really want to hear from you and learn what you like and don't like about this program. My email address is opr@telus.net, T-E-L-U-S. Or if you don't like email, my postal address is Old Parlor Radio, 2080 15th Avenue, Prince George, B.C., Canada, Victor 2 Mike, 1 Tango 1. From the CFIS studios in Prince George, I'm Corey Walker, wishing you a happy Canada Day or Independence Day.